Welcome to Planet Poetry. My name's Peter Kenny.
And I'm Robin Houghton. And in this episode, we're talking to Sean Hewitt about his collection Rapture's Road, published by Cape.
And we'll live up to our Planet Poetry name by visiting, poetically of course, the Netherlands, Somalia and South Korea.
We're such world travellers, aren't we, Peter?
We are.
But first, a quick hop over to Dublin takes us to Sean Hewitt. Let's hear what he had to say to Peter.
Sean Hewitt's debut collection of poetry, Tongues of Fire, won the Laurel Prize in 2021 and was shortlisted for the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award, the John Pollard Foundation International Poetry Prize, and a Dalkey Literary Award. In 2020, he was chosen by the Sunday Times as one of their 30 under 30 artists in Ireland. His second collection of poetry, Rapture's Road, was published in 2024, and this is the publication we focus on today. Additionally, his memoir, All Down Darkness Wide, was published by Jonathan Cape in the UK and Penguin Press in the USA, 2022. It was shortlisted for Biography of the Year at the An Irish Post Book Awards, for the Foyles Book of the Year in Nonfiction, for the RSL Ondaatje Prize, the Polari Prize, and for a Lambda Award. He won the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature in 2022, and a debut novel, Open Heaven, is forthcoming in spring 2025. Sean Hewitt, welcome to Planet Poetry.
Thank you for having me.
We've just had this massive storm, Storm Aisha. Are you in one piece? And where do we find you this morning?
You find me in my apartment in Dublin.
Yeah.
Storm Aisha did come with a vengeance last night. It was howling around the building, but everything seems calm and still and bright this morning. So
we're here today to talk about Rapture's Road, which is it this week it's being published or was it last week?
It was on the 11th of January. So
as I touch it, it's sizzling in my hand. It's so hot off the press. There's a kind of opening poem, a sort of intro.
Okay, it's called A Ministry. Why did you bring me here again, feet? Although it is January, unseasonably cold, there is a gathering in the copse above the lake. Fires, only a few icy stars, the air in the hillocks pocketed with mist. Like the inside of a mussel shell, the way the night sky sheens humid and bone-hard and lucent. The dark-haired youth dancing between the rowans in his red flame-stitched tunic is not me. I like it when his torso snaps, when he puts this vine of windflowers between my lips. Little bird, he likes it when I break among the tamarisk, the feather moss, setting the paper wings in the grass aflight. I suppose it is just like grief to open until a voice comes out. Just so, how each night I play both sinner and priest, assigning prayers, the dog collar, the dove, the blister of thorns. Yes, I have been here before. Soon the fires will smoke white with the sound of pines. One of us will be chosen. I have tried each time to be kind to myself, to forgive both men. Between the ornate screen of the winter branches, I walk my body, or my body walks me. Firmer now, the dark-haired youth behind me. He likes it. He likes me when I break. It gives him something to assemble. Good boy, good mirror. A white moth settles on my tongue. Beautiful and mine, these nights I fall, forgive, commit. And only now does God, our audience of one, come in to lift the blanket from my cage. When I break predictably into song.
That's just such a strong and stunning opener. There's so many little bombs that go off for me as a reader when I'm reading through that. First, you have this aliveness to the natural world and a sense of going into a special place. But then it's who you meet there, the dark-haired youth dancing between the rowans. His red flame-stitched tunic is not me. When somebody tells you in a poem that the person they're describing is not you, you think, well, why would I have assumed that it wasn't you? Or, you know, so there's a sort of blurring of identity about who we're talking about.
I wrote this poem, first off, looking at Botticelli's Spring.
Oh, yeah.
In which there is, in the left-hand corner, as you look at the painting, a young man with dark hair and he has flames stitched into his tunic. So he came to me there. But this poem became a sort of dance between two selves for me.
Yes.
So this is my second collection. And I was thinking about the self that wrote the first collection, which is called Tongues of Fire. So I was trying to kind of secretly put him into the younger self with the flame stitch tunic.
Encouraging people to go back and buy Tongues of Fire as well.
Yes.
Which is excellent.
You know, I think this poem could feel, and in fact, a lot of the poems in this book could feel like love poems between one man and another. But in some ways, in my head, they were tussle between two versions of one person. One who relied in some way on confession and breakdown and, you know, all of these things that poetry can be made of. He likes it when I break. That's the old version. And this new self that kind of wanted to do something a bit different. So I kind of set it up as an introduction. If anyone had read Tongues of Fire, they might read this poem and see a departure.
Yeah. Well, I love this. I play both sinner and priest. One of us will be chosen. There is that kind of dual identity in there. Maybe this is a mad tangent. Many decades ago, the Writer's and Artist's Yearbook had this introduction about how to send off your poems and so on. And it said, many are called, but few are chosen. And I've always thought that was really apposite, but it was making me think of, you know, this is actually also one of the versions of you being sort of called out to be a writer, to be a poet. You know, when you end with, when I break predictably into song, you know. You introduce us to a world as well, you know, that natural aliveness, and we're sort of entering a weird psychological space as well as a geographical one. And
yeah, I wanted it to be, you know, the introduction to a dream in some ways.
Yeah.
It's good to hear that it feels kind of psychological and alive and strange, because that is what I wanted you to enter the book in that mood.
Totally. Would you read Dispersion Song?
The first one. This has become a habit now, I think, of putting two poems of the same title in a book. Tongues of Fire had two evening poems in it. So, Dispersion Song. Oh, hoverfly, a gnat and aphid, stitched music of the sallow plough. Mosquitoes, draw out my blood for him, make me a cloud of wings. Oh, insects, knitting a song for him, in the sways of the sycamore dark, lay your veil across my head. Marry me. I am a bride for you tonight.
But it's really fascinating, this kind of, you're melting away into all these little entities, you know, like a tiny flock of Keatsian nightingales or something. You know,
yeah.
I sort of, especially the first two lines, you talk about, oh, hoverfly and gnat and aphid, stitched music of the sallow plough. And it was making me think of Ode to Autumn, you know, the gnats and the, he uses the word sallow as well. But
yes, yeah, that was perhaps in the back of my head there. You can't escape Keats.
No.
Or I can't.
Oh, well, I'm pleased you say that, because for me, this collection kind of, Keats is one of the kind of shadowy figures. One thing this poem made me feel was about, you know, what's unsaid. And there's a lot of sort of suggestion in your poems. And, you know, in this, these insects drawing out your blood and dispersing and kind of knitting a song for him in the sways of the sycamore dark. But things are kind of, there's a sense of melting into the space towards possibly another, but you know, there's so much to guess at, and that is exactly the kind of poem I like as well, that leads you your brain dispersed in all kinds of directions thinking, wow, what, you know, what's going on there?
Well, I think sometimes it's good, you know, more so in this book than in my last one, I became quite interested in poems that maybe were just at the edge of my own understanding. So sometimes I would finish a poem and be very happy with it, but if I had to summarize what I thought it was about, I might even struggle myself, you know. So I liked pushing towards that mysterious, or you said suggestive, space. And I think music can kind of help you do that as well.
Yeah, I think perhaps rather pretentiously think of poetry as a kind of a way of annexing areas from silence, that, you know, trying to say things or suggest things that have not been suggested before. And that's why poetry is so good at that, whereas I don't find other ways of writing do that quite so well.
Annexing from silence is a really good way of putting it. I like that a lot.
Would you read We Didn't Mean to Kill Mr. Flynn?
I'll tell the listeners a little bit about this poem before I start. I was a poet in residence at the Irish Queer Archive, which is at the National Library of Ireland. And I was in that job for, well, a full year, and I had to write 10 poems. So one thing that you won't hear when I read this poem is that it's all footnoted. So many of the lines and sentences you hear are quotations from documents in this archive. Declan Flynn was a young man who was killed in Fairview Park on the north side of Dublin in 1982 by a gang of men who were later let off with a suspended sentence for manslaughter. And this turned into what is widely thought of as being the first pride march in Ireland as a protest against that court judgment. So the first part of this poem is told in the voice of the killers, using court statements and bits from newspapers. And the second is told in the voice of Declan Flynn himself. And the only word that might come up here that some listeners might not know is Glasnevin, which is the name of the biggest cemetery on the north side of Dublin. So this begins with an epigraph, which is from a court statement reported in the Irish Times on the 9th of March, 1983. We didn't mean to kill Mr. Flynn. I thought he was gay and was in the park to meet other gay people. We had been queer bashing during the summer. One. It was easy to get good sticks. There were plenty of trees with low branches. We were waiting in the shadows there with cudgels, our hoods over our faces. Paddy shouted twice, "Get the bastard." We'd battered 20 steamers that summer, the team of us clearing the park of queers and pedos. Maybe that time we went too far, but with perverts you have to do something physical, castration, I don't know. So we ran, all of us, and chased him until he fell. And all I can think of now is the blood coming from the man's mouth. I turned him on his side so he wouldn't choke. He was heavy. I remember that. And then he went quiet, limp, and it sunk in that he was after dying. Two. It was a warm night in Fairview. Not an olive grove, but another Gethsemane of birch and sycamore by the brackish tide, the obscenities of the rooks and gulls, good for hiding in, which was its blessing and its curse. I had a stammer and froze up when they shouted, and the trees I trusted to cover me lent them their branches, flaying and whipping until the shadow fell. And that was me, on the ground when he came, just a slight gurgling noise, the blood pumping from my mouth. I drowned on it, they said. They made my own life drown me. Then my father weeping by the fire. A betraying kiss, perhaps, but no stone rolled back, no ascension. They walked out of court free, he said, but my son cannot walk out of Glasnevin.
Yeah, that's fantastic. For me, one of the things that makes it so strong is that kind of appropriation of the voices of the people that were the criminals here, because it would be so easy to write a poem that was just full of outrage and condemnation, but actually having them condemn themselves by their own mouths, using their own reported speech from newspapers and so on, was a bit of a masterstroke here. It kind of balances it and just gives it so much more power.
I wrote quite a lot of other poems during this commission, and all of them were footnoted. And my main idea was, you know, often my poems have an eye which is close to me. And I wanted these poems to really be a sort of window into the archive, rather than being my poems per se.
Well, that's interesting.
Let the voices in the archive speak for themselves rather than me having to speak on their behalf.
And is that a kind of natural impulse for you, do you think, also to try and see both sides when you're as a writer? Do you think there is a kind of duty as a writer to be impartial?
I think it's perhaps more about poetry itself. When I write a poem, which is perhaps what happens to other people as well, is you spend a long time tweaking things and changing things. And ideally, you want the poem to, when it's finished, be read in many ways, and have something, you know, you can turn it and see another side and turn it and see another side. So I think poetry in that way lends itself to empathy. It's a sort of technology of empathy. And you ideally want to make something with a sort of complexity that doesn't reduce itself the more you read it, but actually increases the more you read it. So I think poetic form probably leads me into empathetic thinking.
That's really interesting. I'd like to think about how you place your writing in terms of an Irish poetical heritage. I think a good poem to illustrate that would be Two Apparitions.
Two Apparitions. This is a poem in two parts. One. I thought I had woken from the dream, but stepping into the stark light of the bathroom, I saw my father in the mirror behind me and froze, clamped shut my eyes and could not speak. Two worlds overlaid, whirring of the extractor, white tiles, the air somehow synthetic, as though I might reach through it and touch him. Then it was me and not him who was gone. The room all at once saying, who is it? Who is it? And I with no breath to answer. Two. A week later, I woke dead on 3 a.m. This time I was the ghost, this time caught on the wrong side of the dream. Somewhere in that other place, all happiness, all peace, the morning station where we met in gold and filtered light. I remembered the exact weight of him, the warmth of his cheek touching mine. And now, locked out, I cried at the foot of the bed, hit it with my fist, tried to tear my way back to him as though I might, by force of myself, go free.
Do you see yourself as writing in an Irish literary tradition?
I think I do, inevitably, not only in terms of what I spend my time reading often. I do, of course, read international poets as well, but the Irish tradition is close to home in that way. But I also studied it. I did a master's and then a PhD in Irish literature, and now I teach Irish literature. So I think inevitably a lot of my thinking time comes through the reading of Irish poets, and their voices then begin to kind of haunt the poems that you write. I think often those are the model poems that inspire me or give me an idea to begin writing one of my own poems. So my poems probably have echoes of earlier poets inside them. often.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's I think that's often a good thing as well, to show that the language has roots and things. I mean, I do detect quite a bit of Yeats, Two Apparitions, you know, that sort of Yeats has got poems about shades and so on, that Yeats and Augusta Gregory and all those people, you know, delving into Irish folklore and so on. It's so rich.
Yeah, I mean, those are two of my heroes. And I'm glad you can hear a bit of Yeats in that. I don't think anyone has ever said that to me before. But he's definitely in there.
I think I've got overdeveloped Yeats antennae, though.
No, that's good. That's good. I think I have too. And I would love to. I love the idea that he might be behind the poems as an apparition himself.
Yeah.
But I love Yeats's kind of high syntax, and he can be quite an austere poet. And he has an utter belief in things that I suppose I don't believe in, but that make the world richer for me and more enchanted and mysterious. And I think, you know, poems can do that. They don't always have to be in the sparse real world.
But in Tongues of Fire, there's a sequence, forgive my pronunciation, Bule Sivna, which is like Mad Sivna. And that was very, you know, the antecedents of Yeats was fairly clear to me there.
Yeah, I mean, everyone always picks up with Heaney on that poem because Heaney also did his translations. But, you know, T.S. Eliot had Sweeney poems as well. And
yes, that's right.
You know, he has roots in the modernists. Those poems came about for I was learning Irish. And I tend to learn languages by trying to translate things that I like. It makes it more fun to me. So I translated that poem kind of word for word originally, and then made it into lyric poems. But yeah, I think, you know, it, perhaps in a similar way to Yeats or Gregory, or writers like Hardy, I suppose, I'm quite interested in these enduring histories that seem often quite other to the modern world.
Yeah,
and I think they have a lot of power in that.
And I think that's one of the reasons I'm enjoying this book so much, because you're writing about ghosts, which, frankly, most people hoo-ha. But actually, I think, you know, they're tremendously interesting ideas. The second part of that, of the two apparitions, you know, I remember the exact weight of him, the warmth of his cheek touching mine, and that sense of a now empty bed. It's almost like the modern usage of being ghosted as well, you know, that somebody's kind of just quietly removed themselves from your life one way or another.
One thing I hold quite true to is, you know, ghosts may not be real. I'm not here as an advocate for the reality of them. But often I think we experience things that feel to us at the time ghostly.
Yes.
Whether it's a kind of deja vu moment or in this case, you know, this was a relatively real occurrence. I went through a period when I had sleep paralysis a couple of times, and then thankfully it went away. But you know those moments where it's the middle of the night and you wake up and you're still kind of half inside a dream, and suddenly, you know, even if only for 30 seconds or something, the world around you seems very surreal. The light coming in from the window looks like a person on the wall. For a while, you kind of fully believe it until you fully wake up and then you realize that it's just the light on the window. But I think in that moment, you believe in a ghost or you believe in a spiritual world, and then your rational mind kicks in and tells you what it actually is. But I wanted to put the poem in that moment of belief rather than the rationalization of the belief.
Yeah, there's two really deft and beautiful poems that to my mind are linked. One's called Did You Fall in Love Before You Met? And the other one, which is on the page afterwards, called Snows. Would you read those two, please?
Yeah, of course. A lot of these poems don't have titles, so and this is one of them. Did you fall in love before you met my father? What shames have kept you awake? Did you ever regret your life? Mother, I do not remember your first word to me, nor the first time I cried for you, nor when first I gripped my fist around your tiny finger. Mother, forgive me, I do not remember meeting you. Snows. By my age, the snows of my father's life were already half fallen. What is that sound? The white heart leaping through its dark estate. Frost on the eyes of the animals. Frost in the mouths of the trees.
One thing I'm so much enjoying about your writing is that you're not afraid to make a poem beautiful.
Thank you. A lot of these poems, perhaps like other people's poems, began much longer. You know, this poem, Snows, I think those two stanzas were part of a much longer poem to begin with. And then I cut it back and cut it back and cut it back until I thought actually everything I wanted to say was could just be held in the image of those two stanzas and didn't need all the explanation.
Beautifully spare. I mean, it's literally just six short lines on a page in two stanza. The poem about all the things that you don't remember about your mother, it's an apology, but these are things that you can't really have been able to remember.
One of the things that was preoccupying me at that point is these people who are very close to us, obviously, are our parents. There are things that we don't ask them. And then that perhaps you don't have the chance to ask them. And it's part of kind of learning that your parent is a whole person in the same way that you are a whole person. You know, They had a life before you came along. And I think, you know, if one thing I'm thinking about more as I go through life, it's how much experience a life holds. And so in some ways, how much we don't know about other people. You couldn't possibly even scratch the surface sometimes of people's experience in life.
I've been looking at your website, which I think is very professional and excellent. On there, you describe yourself as a lyric poet in one of the videos. What does being a lyric poet mean for you?
Well, for a start, I suppose it means that these poems are musical. Or I want them to be musical. I think a lot about rhythm and sound, and I want them to almost act as little songs of their own. So that would be my primary idea of lyricism, but also that they usually contain an I or a speaking voice, as though they're coming directly from me to you. And although they do sometimes tell stories, I think they tell stories as a collection of poems rather than as poems in their own right. You know, one poem does not tell the whole narrative.
That suits you very well, doesn't it? Because you like building in the idea of guessing at things as well.
Yeah, I like the idea that, you know, if you read the book a couple of times, you'd start to see connections between poems or repeated ideas, and the book itself would kind of build up this narrative in the silence, narrative in the silence of the book, which is inside your head, which I like.
Well, let's change gear a bit and go on to a poor unfortunate pig.
Yes, this is a poem just quite boldly titled Pig. I heard the steel handle of the paddock gate, the gutter of diesel fume above the haze shimmer of the liquid field. And I was the executioner, unhooded among the crowd of children clamorous with their summer faces, the fat sow in the quad bike trap, her nerves misfiring with the whine of the engine. I heard her screech, the awful thud of her bucking against the wooden slats, and then the fire, the clean secateurs, and the sun hot like peace across the knife blade. But when I held the heft of her body open, the children's hands unafraid on the blistered string of nipples, and heaved out the folded, luxurious parachute of her innards. It felt almost like love to have stolen and then reinscribed death's random, impersonal machinery.
Its place in this collection really shows that you've got that ability to look unflinchingly at something in your locker. I wonder if being able to do that kind of buys the right to be more ethereal in this almost a Celtic twilight feel of some of the book.
Yeah, I think that is what I was going to say. That's exactly right. I think I'm quite interested in how violence can purchase beauty in that way, or purchase the place for beauty. I think that's perhaps something that I learned from Yeats, maybe. He was a very unafraid poet for tackling violence and seaminess, especially in his later poems. And, you know, I had this poem sitting in a folder for a while. It actually comes almost from life. I was volunteering at a school in Romania, in a rural village. And at the end of the week, the villagers brought out a pig as a celebration so we could eat it. And I was absolutely terrified. I was only about 16. But it would have been very rude to show that terror, I thought. So I helped. And it was a confrontation with a sort of violence that, although it's violence, of course, it's something that the vast majority of people benefit from every single day of their lives, you know. So although it was a violent experience, it was also quite, well, it gave me a sense of the whole, in terms of this is where your food comes from. This is where everything starts and ends. I don't want to look away from those things in looking at the natural world or at death and life, you know, these big topics that are addressed in the book. Would I not just be a hypocrite or glossing over things if I didn't turn a gaze there too?
I'd like you to read A Strain on the Earth's Sweet Being.
This is quite a strange poem. I was hoping at some point to do a translation of Deirdre of the Sorrows from the Ulster cycle to kind of complement the Bulishivna in Tongues of Fire. But I didn't really find what I needed in it at that time. But it still sparked off a couple of lines from this. I think I may have stolen some of the ideas from Deirdre's famous lament in that myth. So this is A Strain of the Earth's Sweet Being, the title coming from Hopkins. I broke my seal to find you, and light came out tonight. I held it in my mouth like a phoneme and sang with my eyes tonight. I felt the hot white cinder of your crest, your blazon on my skin tonight. Enlist me, burn and brand me. I am all locked down tonight. I have laid out your images, love. I have mimicked you in song tonight. I've laid the fragrance of you on my sheets, dipped my hands in your scent tonight. In a sleepwalk on the fence posts, I left your amber dripping gold tonight. In the ruins of the gorse fires, the brakes smoke the musk of our skins tonight. Lost, I had locked the door on you. I found you prisoned in a word tonight. Come out, make a verb of me. Let my body do your speaking tonight. This poem again came from a very long document I was keeping about a sunset over Phoenix Park. And I had a lot of these kind of images running through it, but I didn't quite know what the poem was about. And then I wrote that first line and had the idea that it would be a repeating poem with tonight at the end of each sentence.
Again, there's just this sort of ambiguity and beauty there. In a sleepwalk on the fence posts, I left your amber dripping gold tonight. Something changing and upgrading in the ruins of the gorse fires that break smoke the musk of our skins tonight. It's a beautiful love poem as well. It's working on lots and lots of levels.
I was a bit inspired as well by Lady Gregory's poem, which is called Donalogue, which begins in a very strange way. It is late last night, the dog was speaking of you. And kind of has this repeating thing that crescendos into you have stolen my east. I think actually maybe W.H. Auden was stealing from it in Funeral Blues.
Oh, yeah.
It's a translation of an Irish poem. But I loved the strangeness of Gregory keeping the syntax of the Irish language in the translation. So it is late last night, the dog was talking of you, you know, the mixture of tenses in there. And it doesn't necessarily, you know, make sense. but I like those poems that just leave that nonsensical thing there because it sounds great and it puts the image immediately in your head. So yeah, some of these lines here, I suppose, take that as an impetus.
Yeah, it just kind of feels organic in a way that I like that when almost accidents or uncomfortablenesses are retained, because those kind of things bring things to life quite often.
Yeah, I agree.
Having lurked on your website a bit, you were saying that you wrote maybe one poem a month or something, but you know, you wait for it to come in a way. And it was making me think of Keats's thought about if poetry comes not as naturally as leaves to a tree, it had better not come at all. In my experience, there's nothing worse than trying to force a poem out.
Yeah, I mean, forcing a poem never results in a good poem, in my experience. I've tried, believe me, I've tried forcing poems quite often. But I've learned now what I tend to do is keep a document or a notebook in which every time a line or a image or an idea comes to me, I write it down. And eventually it seems to get to the point where, you know, sort of like an avalanche. If you write enough notes down and words down, eventually it kind of tumbles into a poem and it grips you all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you'll write an idea for a poem about hawthorns, and then you're walking around for a couple of weeks and you remember, you know, this time you were in this place with this person and there were hawthorns coming out. And then you think, oh, maybe that is something that the hawthorn poem is about. And then you maybe note that down and another thing comes. And eventually you feel that the poem begins to write itself or begins to come out. So I never force a poem, which is why I'm historically bad at commissioned poems.
Yeah, I've had people asking me to write poems for weddings and things, and that my toes are always curling when I'm reading them.
Yeah, no, very difficult. I've had to do that before as well. But I'm always amazed by people who can write a wedding poem and it's amazing and then it goes in a book. And, you know, I don't know how people do that.
It's always lovely when you can end an interview on a really hopeful, upbeat note. And there's this gorgeous poem towards the end of your book called Hope.
Yeah.
I think this may well be a very excellent way to end our conversation.
Sure. Well, it's been so lovely to spend the morning talking to you. Hope. White stars winding the edge of the garden. I take you by the hand to see the constellation of eggs on the sycamore leaves. Nephew who squeals for his love of the world, who waits with water for the robin to thirst from its nest, who loves in all boyish tenderness the moth that patters on the white walls, a message from the nightwood, frantic, saying moon, moon, or mate, saying home and finding his hand.
Sean Hewitt, thank you so much for coming on Planet Poetry.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I really enjoyed that interview, Peter. And Sean Hewitt, he's the real deal, isn't he?
I think so, yeah.
There were just so many interesting points that came up. I loved the poems, and they have a real delicacy, don't they?
I always talk about Yeats, but there is a similarity in that, you know, a lot of his poetry is very beautiful and drawn from images of nature and so on. And just, you know, has a kind of symbolic heft to it. But then he also tackles big public events. In that poem, "We Didn't Mean to Kill Mr. Flynn," because we've got the advantage of seeing it on the page, that actually, you know, everything's footnoted, like he said. He's allowing the people to condemn themselves with their own language. But it just kind of makes it entirely rigorous somehow, and yet still absolutely poetical.
Some of these shorter poems that he read, like Dispersion Song,
yeah.
Oh Hoverfly and Gnat and Aphid, Stitched Music of the Sallow Plough. It just has that, it's such a little gem. It's just a little jewel. It's only 8 lines and it has this incantation sound to it. And again, another little poem, Snows. I think he said about Snows that it was longer, but he distilled it until actually he felt that's all he needed to say what he wanted to say.
Yeah, Snows is just simply 6 lines, you know.
He described himself as a lyric poet, and you said, what does being a lyric poet mean to you? And I thought his answer was really interesting. That first of all, musical, yes, I get the music.
Yeah.
And then he said, didn't he, about poems that contain an I or a speaking voice, so it's a sort of direct from me to you.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that. And most of all, when he said he felt that they don't tell stories on their own, they're part of a collection, so the story, if you like, is the collection rather than standalone little stories.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that as part of his definition as well.
The poems aren't written for competitions. There is that sense of them being fragments of a whole.
Yes.
And just dipping in a way, does a disservice to some of the other poems in there. This phrase in the pig poem, "heaved out the folded, luxurious parachute of her innards." That's such an amazing tumbling out. You know, it's not an obvious connection.
Not at all, no.
But in its place, it suddenly works really well and makes it fresh.
He made a comment, didn't he, about wanting a poem, you know, one wants a poem to be read in many ways. And what he was after was not that the more you read something, the clearer it becomes, but the more you read something, the more layers and the more interesting and actually more complexity there is in it.
Yeah, they seem to have that ability to multiply meanings without ever seeming vague, which I think is a wonderful balancing act. This poem about the two apparitions.
Oh, yes.
One waking from sleep and seeing his father in the mirror, two worlds overlaid, whether the apparition is a real thing or not. And, you know, when we were talking, he wasn't advocating ghosts. But there's a bravery around taking on what's unfashionable.
He was trying to give voice to the ghostly feeling that you can have at times when you're half asleep or half awake or in that liminal space, when something feels ghostly, even though you're not saying, oh, yeah, I saw a ghost.
Yeah.
Do you think it's to do with the spiritual as well, and an acknowledgement that there is the spiritual in us, even the most so-called rational of people? And when the poem about his mother, wasn't that beautiful? Imagining, I'm sorry, I don't remember when we first met, and he talks about the first time his hand closed around her finger,
and it
was so beautiful. And as he said it, you just realise how much you just don't know other people.
Yeah.
That's the unknown, and that's kind of the ghostliness as well, isn't it? The complete unknown.
Yeah. You know, like he's saying, it's that kind of liminal moment of waking up and your normal conscious ideas about what's true and false. And I think that's such a fertile, that liminality is so fertile for poetry, because it hasn't been hijacked by the obvious explanations. There is a place where doubt can exist, and that just seems to me to be tremendously interesting.
It must be for both of us, because look how we fired off it.
Yeah. His last poem about hope.
Yes, that was so beautiful.
And it's just like him and his nephew who squeals for his love of the world, who waits with water for the robin to thirst from its nest. I mean, It's quite timeless, and it's in a way quite old-fashioned.
Yes.
The other ghost for me that was in there was Keats.
Yes.
One of his poems was reminding me of some of the language in Ode to Autumn.
Hope made me think of Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, some of those, the beautiful, what goes on in the forest, that sort of magical nature.
I'm really, really pleased that I started delving into Sean Hewitt's world, actually. It's sort of reminding me of great writing. His concerns are kind of refreshingly different as well.
And yet he's definitely within a tradition.
Yeah.
I definitely want to read this book.
Today seems to be a special day, doesn't it, Robin?
It certainly is. It's World Poetry Day.
Yay.
March 21st. I must admit, it's not something that I've particularly been aware of much before. I've been aware of it, but I've not sort of known of things happening to celebrate it.
Yeah.
So I looked it up. I thought, let's do a little research. It was actually a UNESCO initiative, and it started in 1999. And I quote from the website, they say, the aim of World Poetry Day is to support linguistic diversity through poetic expression and increase the opportunity for endangered languages to be heard.
Ah, that's interesting.
And indeed, when you go to the UNESCO website, they tell you all the things that are going on, events around the world today to celebrate World Poetry Day. A lot of them in the UNESCO Cities of Literature.
Ooh.
Which is another phenomenon that I have not kept up with, I admit. But there are indeed, at the moment, 43 cities of literature around the world, from Montevideo in Uruguay to Lillehammer in Norway. We've actually got 5 cities of literature in the UK. Do you know any of them, Peter? Do you know?
Well, it's certainly not Seaford, where I live.
Well, we are doing a World Poetry Day event tonight in Eastbourne, but Eastbourne isn't one of them. But they are actually Edinburgh, Exeter, Manchester, Norwich and Nottingham. So big shout out to those 5 cities. I hope you're doing lots today to celebrate World Poetry Day. So from there, I started Googling. I was thinking, let's have an international feel.
Because we are Planet Poetry, aren't we?
We are Planet Poetry, and we do have international guests, but I thought, well, you know, is there anything else we can be talking about today in particular? And for some reason, I was Googling, and I found a very good website called Poetry International, which was quite an interesting resource for finding world poets. Does one talk of world poets? That sounds like world music, doesn't it? It's sort of world poets.
Yeah, there's something. I always thought there was something a bit belittling about world music.
It is a bit, isn't it? Because it's sort of like, oh, there's us and then there's the world. Morning, world. Poetry International is a Dutch website, and it came out of the Poetry International Festival, which apparently has been running in Rotterdam each June since 1970. I was searching for contemporary female poets. The first one I came across was Ewon from South Korea. And she's, I suppose you'd call her avant-garde, somewhat surrealist. And I came across a handful, only about 2 or 3 poems by her in translation. And I kept searching, and I ended up back in the Netherlands with a poet called Marjolein van Heemstra. I believe she's currently, or has been, the city poet of Amsterdam. So like poet laureate in Amsterdam, and she's published many collections, and I found quite a few of her poems in translation on the internet. According to the biog on her website, she originally studied religious studies with the aim of becoming a conflict mediator. But she's actually, I'm not sure if she went on to do that, but basically she's now a poet, a writer, a theatre maker, a journalist, a podcaster, and she's won various prizes. Something interesting about her performances, it says on the website, she almost always writes and plays herself when she writes. I suppose we're talking about theatrical, poetic performances. Hard to know. I'd like to see some of these. But she writes and plays herself, sometimes with a non-professional player next to her.
A non-professional player? What sort of random?
So I suppose some random person. I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure. But it says, in recent years, as a theatre maker, she's been mainly concerned with Die Nachtwacht, a several-year investigation into the value of night and darkness in a city with far too much light.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is very interesting. Sort of twilight sessions, lectures, night walks. So I wanted to read just a short poem by her. It's called Body Scan. At my request, the woman behind the scanner shows me myself. I was curious about the deepest visible skin, about the layer beneath nakedness. With glossy fingers, she shows me the spots. The scan, she says, measures your temperature. This is heat, where it lights up, and this is cold. I see the soil climate in which I thrive, and the hot circuit laying life in me. There is plenty of activity around my stomach, a radiating circle reaching almost to my heart. My arms hang dark and aimless by my trunk, though. My head, a moonless night, three pale comets emitting a dusky glow. Nothing shines in my shoulders, and my legs go out halfway. A queue is forming behind me. Further on, an aeroplane waits. But I stand, nailed to the floor in front of the computer screen, an undersized paramecium, black as black, astonished by the scope of my darkness.
Wow, that's fantastic. I absolutely love that.
I love that. I had to look up the word paramecium, which means like a microscopic thing.
Single-celled
in the water. Yeah, you know, you know. So, but I just thought that was really fun and unexpected and different. I started thinking it was a scan, like a medical scan. It says that she's at the airport. You imagine people standing in a queue behind that.
Everybody else is just shuffling through as fast as they can. And yeah, somebody having a poetic moment, you know. It's like, just get on with it.
Excellent. So that was my brief foray into world poetry. And I think you've been doing something a bit similar, haven't you? Without even realising it.
I've been reading this really excellent collection of essays. It's called Living in Language, edited by Erica Hesketh, which has just been published by the Poetry Translation Centre. And in fact, there are a few podcast pals on here already. So Ali Reza Abiz that we spoke to has translated an essay. And there's an essay from Yang Lian, translated by his faithful translator, Brian Holton. So it's got all these short essays, letters, fragmentary pieces of prose that contain reflections on, to quote the book jacket, writing the body, writing in exile, writing as witness, writing as a shamanic act, grappling with traditional forms, finding your own voice, and so on. And it's got poets writing in all kinds of languages, and you were talking about kind of these vanishing languages from the the UNESCO site. Well, one of them is Zapotec, which is a language found in Mexico, and there's 500,000 speakers apparently. So as you can imagine, there's a huge amount of variety in here, and it's quite difficult to condense it all. I found some of the poets writing about their practice reminded me of how universal the business of writing poetry is. And a lot of it seemed quite familiar, struggles of writing and sorting through your poetry. But two essays caught my eye. One is an absolutely brilliant essay called Poetry Practices Being Caught in the Act by a Korean poet called Lee Hyemi. I Googled her and it turns out she was born in 1988. And the essay is translated from the Korean by Soji. But I just wanted to read a bit of it because the freshness and aliveness of this essay, it's in a few very short sections, but the second section is called Secretly or Getting Caught Winking. She says, not long ago, I hid a love letter in a library book and wrote down the shelf mark number for my lover. I imagine them going to the library, searching for the book, and eventually reading my confessions inside a letter, inside a book. Doesn't this stunt of mine, that is, hiding a juicy secret for eyes to glimpse behind the solid door of a book, resemble the writing of poetry. Amusingly, my lover mistook the shelf mark number for a flight number, and come to think of it, aeroplanes and books do both transport us to other worlds. My surprise gift may not have worked out as planned, but I was able to present a letter with time elapsed in its mouth. Why did I risk hiding my letter somewhere unfamiliar to me and my lover? Let me tell you, to create a secret, in a covert act of solidarity and collusion, Baudelaire, translated by A.S. Klein, was right. What is tedious about lovemaking is that it is a crime where one cannot do without an accomplice. The inexplicable bond between a writer and their reader has to do with the sedition, and so poetry gives hand signals, reads the room, plays tricks, holds back laughter. It is a train passing through a tunnel, an optical illusion, a stolen kiss. So it's just the playful joyousness of it. And she talks later in the essay about the past delivering the baton of memory to the present. It's so alive and vibrant.
I love that idea of airplanes and books. They have something in common. You know, they take us to different places. So he mistook the reference on the bookshelf for a flight number.
Can you imagine the annoyingness of turning up at the airport thinking, yippee, I'm going away. And it's like, no, it's a library book. We're guessing, of course, it's a him. We don't know. But
We don't know.
Yeah. This book gives you glimpses into kind of other poetic cultures and ways of thinking, of course. Another essay that I really enjoyed was Substantial Words, Mastering the Gabay by Asha Lowell Mohammed Yusuf. And it's been translated from the Somali by Martin Orwin. And he gives us the note that Gabay is a long-line form of poetry in Somali, which comprises two half-lines of unequal length, each with its own metrical pattern. But what really interested me was, you know how when we're writing, the idea of, you know, constantly harvesting new words and finding exciting ways of saying new things seems to be a fairly accepted part of writing. This poet says, "I include substantial words in my poems so that young people from my community benefit from them also. I take care that what I write doesn't include the language of the street or new words which young people use in their speech, because I believe that literature enriches and expands the language. It takes care of it so that it is not lost. The people who are experts in literature say that literature is the place where the Somali language is brought down from or downloaded from. I take this responsibility seriously and so give my gabays the weight they deserve by choosing serious words of high quality."
I like that. That's different, isn't it? That's a different, sort of setting the standard.
Protecting the culture by being very serious and rigorous about the language. I thought that's a really different way of thinking about it.
It is, isn't it? Rather than kind of using the language that the kids are going to understand or the words that they use, appropriating that.
And she includes a poem that she's written, and it's essentially about how men exploit women. It was interesting to me because, you know, it starts talking about social media. And so despite her protection of this Somali word hoard, she's also kind of engaging with new things. So there's lots of stanzas to this poem. I'll just read one. Every stanza ends with this line, "May a girl not go with him." So it describes different kinds of men and how they exploit women. And she's kind of wishing that no girl will go with that man. So here's one stanza. "The man who betrays the good woman he has married and lain with in bed, whose duties God gave her to do for him, who made her special to him, who bore children for him and raised them with love, who is closer to him than his own clothes, the man who sells her shame and puts it on Facebook, exposing her to the world, is a useless person who lacks shame, has lost all sense, whose morality has been cut from him. May a girl not go with him."
Oh, I like that. That's a, it's a curse. It's a curse poem, isn't it?
So she, I love the way she's kind of doing this protecting of the language and everything, but also being a really fierce, dynamic poet at the same time.
Yes.
So just two of the splendours in that book, but I do recommend it. So it's from the Poetry Translation Centre.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes in at a cheeky £15. I was surprised to find Ursula K. Le Guin in there writing letters to an Argentinian poet or swapping letters with her. Because I really like Ursula K. Le Guin's fiction.
Yes.
Particularly a book called The Left Hand of Darkness.
Darkness, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's a classic, isn't it? Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, yeah.
So great to see her cropping up there and unexpected as well, for me at least. So, heartily recommended. So, we're Planet Poetry and it's World Poetry Day. Are you doing anything to celebrate, Robin?
Well, I mentioned very briefly earlier that in Eastbourne, we are having a... Don't laugh.
A node of international poetry.
We're having a little get-together at the Fisherman's Club.
So, Robin, I hear that in the course of your researches, you learned all about the Korean flag.
In a way, the Korean flag is a work of poetry, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I've sometimes passed by the South Korean embassy in London and the flag's hanging outside. And it's very distinctive. I don't know if you can picture it. It's got a white background. And in the centre, there's a sort of a red and blue, almost like a yin-yang symbol. It's kind of upside down. And then it's got around the circle, there are these four black... sort of diagrams. I've learned that they're called trigrams, so in each corner. And I've often thought, what do they mean? Because they're all slightly different. And they all have very specific symbolism. So basically, yin-yangy type symbol in the centre is indeed to do with balance. And it's red and green, red and blue, because blue represents negative energy and red represents positive energy. And then the trigrams... You could read them as the equinoxes, the summer solstice, spring equinox, fall equinox, winter solstice. You could read them as family members. So you've got a father and a daughter and a mother and a son. It's sort of very traditional. You could read them as animals. They represent body parts, other attributes. They represent the seasons, the four seasons in nature. So they've got these multiple meanings, and it's all to do with balance and nature and the place in the world if you are Korean. And also it represents the Korean people, the race, if you like, rather than the state. So apparently burning the flag is something you don't really see in, because the flag doesn't represent a state, it represents the people. So I only scratched the surface, as you can tell. But I just thought that this is amazing. I'm sure that maybe it's true of all flags. Maybe it's true of the Union flag. I know it represents different countries, but I just was quite fascinated by how much is encompassed in this flag. It felt like a poem.
Yeah, it sounds like a book of poems. An anthology of flags or something.
Yes, yes, yes.
Let's do it. You shouldn't say it. It's £1 million. It's a T.S. Eliot award-winning prize, that one.
Right, I'm on it.